Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Now, here's a curious thing. We learned this morning Bank of America needs another $35 billion just in case the economy gets worse. Today on the program, why that is good news and how B of A might come up with the cash. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, helping more than 250,000 small businesses and nonprofits succeed using email marketing. ConstantContact.com. American Public Media presents documentary reporting on the economic crisis, supported by the University of Virginia's Batten Institute. More at AmericanRadioWorks.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 6th of May. Glad you could be with us. Here's the difference between big banks and you and me. If we need more money, we go to the ATM, where we pick up some cash. When banks need money, first of all, it's called capital, not cash. And second, the money machine they can usually run to is called the stock market, which presents its own slew of problems. So to explain how else Bank of America and the other stress-tested banks might bump up their capital, we've called Karen Shaw Petru at Federal Financial Analytics in Washington. Karen, good to have you here.
Thanks so much.
This was a very big number splashed in some very big headlines today. Break it down for me, though, and tell me in layman's terms what it means that B of A needs $34 billion.
In layman terms, it means they need a really large amount of money. It means that to meet regulatory capital ratios, they need to adjust their capital by that amount.
All right. Well, how might they go about it? The simplest way I can think of is they print more stock, sell it, and make $34 billion that way.
That would be the simplest, and that would be the best, because that would mean private capital believes in the bank and is willing to put $34 billion behind that bet. I think that's the least likely of the ways.
All right. Well, what's another way then?
You basically move money from one capital pocket to another. Bank of America, and for that matter, all of the big banks that are under the stress test, have a lot outstanding in preferred stock, which, while it's called stock, is in some ways closer to debt. And that's why the regulators don't feel good about counting that as real hard capital. But you can convert preferred stock into common stock, that tangible common equity.
Is that preferred stock what the government already has?
The government has preferred stock, and private investors have lots of preferred stock in all of these banks. So either or both could convert into common stock and significantly recapitalize Bank of America and the other big banks.
Just to make this clear, common stock is ownership stock. It's owning the company.
That's correct.
Is that going to cost taxpayers any more money?
No. It puts taxpayers at more risk. Preferred stock is called preferred for a reason. It comes ahead of the common stockholders, and it gets a dividend, which reimburses taxpayers. But it's no more out-of-pocket money.
This is what's already happened with Citigroup, right?
That's correct.
Now that we've got, effectively, the results of these stress tests before they've come out, I mean, we know probably half of them, right, before they get officially announced tomorrow. Are we going to know tomorrow the health of the banking system, and is that going to make anybody feel better?
We're going to have, I think, the first clear, tough look at the health of the banking system. The problem wasn't just about what we call liquidity, about markets freezing up out of panic. Behind market fears were real solvency concerns because, at the heart of it, people had taken out mortgages they couldn't repay.
Are we not concerned anymore that the banks are insolvent, or is what's happening today as a result of the stress test designed to prevent that from happening?
It's designed to prevent that from happening. Insolvency, I do not think, will be demonstrated by any of these tests. Trouble, yes. I think almost all of them need to take radical action to improve their balance sheets, actions a lot of them have resisted for far too long.
So in a crazy way, it's actually good news that Bank of America only needs $34 billion.
In a crazy way, it's right. And it's also good news that the market took that today and didn't start jumping off buildings and carrying on, that we're now able to look at $34 billion and say, oh, okay, it's good news in and of itself.
Karen Shaw Petru is Managing Director at Federal Financial Analytics in Washington, D.C. Karen, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Now that the stress test results are all but officially out, there is another big issue for banks to deal with. How to get out of the TARP, the $700 billion bank bailout program. A lot of bankers are pretty eager to give the government back its money and be free of the extra regulations that came with it. But Marketplace's Steve Henn reports they're going to have to clear a couple of hurdles first.
Banks think the Troubled Asset Relief Program is an invitation for the government to go mess with their businesses and their bonus checks. So
the strongest banks have been moving very quickly to get out from under TARP.
Sam Hayes taught investment banking at Harvard Business School. He says before paying the government back, banks will first have to pass the stress test. And word is, they'll need to go to the capital markets and borrow money from investors all on their own.
I think it's a pretty good way to test the water, frankly.
Since last October, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation guaranteed new bank debt. If a bank defaulted, the FDIC would make private investors whole. That made bank borrowing possible. But Doug Diamond at the University of Chicago says forcing a bank to prove investors will buy their debt without government guarantees is a smart move.
So this is a way of sort of giving a market test so the regulators don't have to just use their own stress tests to decide just how creditworthy a given bank is.
Banks have used FDIC guarantees to cheaply borrow more than $330 billion. Diamond says normally bankers would be loath to give up this kind of goody, but
they're going to say, well, we don't like your stinking regulations. They got to make sure that they at least give up a few of the subsidies.
Still, bank lobbyists are arguing that forcing their clients to give up these guarantees will rob banks of needed capital and could hurt the economy. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
As far as Wall Street was concerned today, the banks passed those stress tests with flying colors. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. More than anything else today, the leak of those stress test results has been greeted with relief that now, finally, the market has a better picture of how the banking industry is going to get fixed. But it has been 3 months that the government's been working on those tests, 3 months during which the market really hasn't had all that much information. Our New York Bureau Chief Amy Scott reports.
Walter Todd invests money for institutions and wealthy families at Greenwood Capital in Greenwood, South Carolina. When I got him on the phone yesterday, he was about to sell some Bank of America stock in case of bad news.
We're kind of hedging our bets a little bit, and we'll still have plenty of exposure if things go well, but at the same time, taking a little bit off the table ahead of these results, because fear of the unknown is the biggest thing for us.
Even when the official results come out, some question how much investors will really learn. Frank Partnoy teaches securities law at UC San Diego.
The problem with the stress tests is twofold. They're not stressful and they're not tests.
You've heard the metaphor. A doctor tests your heart by putting you on a treadmill and sets it at an incline to make things challenging. So examiners checked how banks would hold up if the economic road gets steeper. Only Partnoy says the Fed didn't apply a worst-case scenario. It assumed unemployment and economic growth wouldn't get too much worse.
The problem with that metaphor with these stress tests is that the treadmill is now at 0 degrees. We thought initially it would be hard to run on this treadmill, but now it's easy.
Officials relied on the bank's own assessment of some of their troubled assets. Partnoy says it's a bit like the doc taking off the electrodes, ignoring the data, and asking, how do you feel?
I feel pretty good.
If Bank of America really needs to raise $34 billion, it's not feeling great. That could be bad news for everyday investors whose pension funds and 401ks often include financial stocks. Dave Ellison is chief financial officer at mutual fund company FBR Fund Advisors. He says regulators should have been doing these stress tests all along.
It's almost as if everybody kind of had this collective brain cramp around the world that we didn't need to do any regulations, that capitalism should be free for everybody, and now we're realizing that we need to regulate certain things, and capitalism is free, but sometimes you need to put it on a leash.
Ellison invests in bank stocks, so he's hoping they'll stage a recovery like they did after the banking crisis of the late 1980s.
The best time to buy financial stocks in my career was from 1990 to 1997. I had stocks that went up 8, 10, 50-fold. because we went from an incredibly ugly period to a much better period driven by better regulatory review and better managements. And the same thing is happening today.
Ellison is not predicting the same kind of stock returns now, and it could be a long time before the banks get back on their feet. The stress tests covered just the 19 biggest banks. Matthew Anderson is with Foresight Analytics. He keeps a watch list of banks with worrisome levels of bad loans or not enough cash on hand.
In the fourth quarter, we had 276 banks on our list. We don't have all the data yet for all the banks in first quarter, but we're estimating that that figure will rise to about 375.
Anderson predicts many of those banks will fail. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
The White House said today it's pleased with the way the Chrysler bankruptcy is progressing. The same can't necessarily be said, though, for Chrysler dealers. The company is planning to close down hundreds of them, at least. In a meeting with dealers yesterday, Chrysler said it'll decide who stays and who goes based on a combination of sales, size, and location. Henry Hagedorn runs a Chrysler Jeep dealership in northern New Jersey. Mr. Hagedorn, good to have you with us.
Good to be with you, Kai.
How's business on day, whatever it is, five or six of the bankruptcy?
Business is still trotting along at a slow rate. We haven't seen an increase and maybe a slight decrease in the new car traffic.
When customers come in, do they mention the bankruptcy and all the things that are happening with Chrysler?
Some do. There's a percentage of the customers that are just our regular buyers that are committed to the product, and there's some that are coming in with questions, you know. They don't know how it affects us, how it's going to affect the product that they're looking to purchase.
Do they understand what the government has said about backing the warranties and making sure all those arrangements are going to be upheld?
I don't think all do. I think there's actually a lack of knowledge. I think that they just hear bankruptcy and Chapter 11. They don't understand that the company will be here.
How much information and support are you getting from Chrysler Corporate?
Actually, they're being very informative. They told us right away on last Friday with a phone conference how they were going to move forward, what their plans were for the dealers. And we are already moving forward with getting financing through GMAC. I was on the phone with them today. And, you know, our lines for writing consumer paper should be open hopefully by Monday.
So consumer financing is working through the General Motors arm of the auto financing branch?
Yes, it will be. It's going to be going through GMAC.
You know, even though Chrysler is talking to you and helping with you and working things out, they are going to close many hundreds of their dealers. Are you worried that you could be one?
Yeah, there's some worry here. We don't know exactly who those dealers are going to be. We're trying to make guesses as to the stronger, the ones that have had retail numbers, that have worked with them on their programs, all the above, and I'm hoping I'm one of those.
How strong are you? How big a franchise? How much business do you do?
Well, we've been one of the top 50 in our in the Eastern Zone here for, you know, over 10 years. Our numbers have dropped off, as all the dealers in the area have. We're probably in the hundreds to a month of new cars, and now we're down, you know, at least to 20, 30, 40, up and down between there.
How long are you expecting it's going to be before all this shakes out?
I think that's going to depend on how soon it takes for the consumer to understand. I think it's going to depend on how long it takes Chrysler to come out of bankruptcy, and I think it's going to depend on how the credit lines open up for the dealers first and for the customers also. So I think by 6 or 8 months from now, you're going to see a stronger company. You're going to see a pent-up demand in the consumer. They're going to know that there's a great product coming out from Chrysler and some new products from Fiat that are very exciting. And if we're around in 6 to 8 months, there's going to be prosperity there.
Henry Hagedorn runs Borough Chrysler Jeep in Wayne, New Jersey. Mr. Hagedorn, thanks a lot for your time.
You're welcome.
Coming up, does branding get us to buy a particular beer?
No, I think people buy because they like it. I don't think ads have to do anything to do with it. People buy because of a taste preference.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials picked up 1.2% today. 101 points closed at 8,512. The NASDAQ gained 0.25%, 5 points, ended things at 1,759. The S&P 500 added 1.75%. That's 15 points, finished at 919. After all that information leaked out about the stress test, it put investors at ease. J.P. Morgan Chase banked nearly 7% on reports it's not going to need more capital. Bank of America pumped up 17% on news that it will. Ditto for Wells Fargo, a 15.5% rise there. Same story for Citigroup. It deposited more than 16% today. There wasn't really much positive to say about retail stocks. Macy's unpacked 6% in advance of retail sales numbers tomorrow. Walmart gave back nearly 2% today, but Target gained a little bit. Its share traded up about 0.5%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.16%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing firsthand consumer reviews on local services like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. Ever wonder what it takes to make an asset toxic? Check out the Marketplace whiteboard on our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve Board reports on consumer credit for March. The Labor Department releases the first quarter preliminary report on productivity and costs. And the House Education and Labor Committee holds a hearing on how schools and workplaces are responding to the current flu outbreak. They'll discuss ways to prepare against future pandemics. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. President Obama made some tax news earlier this week. He said he wants to close loopholes that let companies and individuals keep a lot of their profits offshore. Even though the president does have a lot on his plate already, commentator Robert Reich says there is good reason to take on this fight right now.
Why is President Obama taking aim at corporations that use foreign tax shelters when some think he should keep his powder dry for the much bigger fight coming up over universal health care? Because the two are related. Originally, the White House planned to pay for health care by limiting tax deductions for wealthier Americans. That would have brought in $318 billion over 10 years, half of the president's proposed health care reserve fund. But the Democratic leadership nixed that revenue source. So now, the White House is scrounging for money elsewhere. Foreign tax shelters are an obvious place to look. According to government reports, 83 of the 100 largest publicly held companies are evading U.S. taxes by sheltering their earnings in low-tax zones like Bermuda and the British Virgin Islands. To give you some idea of how much is out there, a tax amnesty 5 years ago brought $300 billion back to the United States. But the administration is not proposing to force companies to bring sheltered money home and pay taxes on it. Its proposal is merely to stop them from deducting the expenses of the shelters from U.S. income they already declare. This alone would bring in more than $100 billion over 10 years. Another $95 billion would come from making it harder for individuals to hide their income in offshore accounts and for companies to shift their income from one foreign subsidiary to another in search of the lowest tax jurisdiction. The total, some $200 billion, is still way short of what's needed for health care. So the White House should go after sheltered corporate income more directly. Regardless of whether you think corporate income taxes are too high, there's no justification for allowing some big companies to use clever tax dodges to avoid paying taxes that other corporations have to pay, especially when the pressure is on to come up with some credible ways to pay for universal health care. If money isn't found, that measure could be vulnerable to deficit hawks who continue to circle ominously.
Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. You can send us your thoughts. Online is best. Go to marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact.
Hey,
InBev, the giant beer conglomerate that bought Anheuser-Busch last fall, reports first quarter profits tomorrow. So we'll see how much the company is bringing in. About the same as last quarter, probably. Analysts say revenue is expected to be fairly flat. But there is some controversy brewing over what InBev pays out and when. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports now from North Carolina Public Radio.
Most of us have to pay our bills within 30 days. If not, we get slapped with hefty interest charges and late fees. But Anheuser-Busch InBev has decided payment due will now mean pay in up to 4 months. The longer pay cycle lets the company collect more interest while creditors are left hanging. Dave Peacock is president of Anheuser-Busch.
In an uncertain economy, we're not a customer that is at risk of not paying. We'll always pay.
But 120 days can seem like never to strapped suppliers and distributors. Most are too thirsty for business to balk, but a backlash is mounting. One supplier in St. Louis, home of Anheuser-Busch, has banned AB InBev products at company functions. And Belgium's economy minister is investigating whether AB InBev's pay period is illegal. Anne Gilpin is an analyst with Morningstar. She says InBev took on too much debt when it acquired Anheuser-Busch last year for $52 billion. She says InBev's management team is wielding a machete to cut costs.
They're very ruthless, not only with how they run things internally, but how they deal with their suppliers and how they deal with their distributors.
But vendor relationships are delicate. Gilpin doesn't expect other firms to adopt the longer pay period unless they, too, are desperate to pay down debt. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Among those who are facing some risk with InBev's new payment policy are its ad agencies, the ones who still have contracts with the company anyway. InBev has cut way back on its marketing budget since the Anheuser-Busch deal last fall. And that includes those Budweiser ads you see during a lot of sporting events. From KWMU in St. Louis, Adam Allington reports.
Even if you don't like Budweiser, even if you're not a beer drinker, you're probably familiar with all those classic Bud ads. Fresh on the heels of its $52 billion joint venture with InBev, the new brewing behemoth is cutting costs everywhere it can, including what many consider to be Anheuser-Busch's core strength, marketing and advertising.
Right now, Anheuser-Busch InBev is desperately in need of funds. Their bankers are sitting on their shoulders saying, gimme, gimme, gimme.
Tom Perko is a beverage industry analyst for BevMark. He says InBev significantly overpaid for Anheuser-Busch, and ramping back ad spending is a good move.
There comes a point you simply have to consider what you're getting for your money. If you see 25 AB ads, what's the difference between saying 25 and saying 12? You know, very little, if anything.
Last year, Anheuser-Busch purchased 100 different TV ads. That number is expected to be cut in half for 2009. Anheuser-Busch president Dave Peacock says the brewer is also reconsidering some of those exclusive sponsorships it has in sports.
We learned that we were almost overly reliant on sports, and we needed to shift some dollars to other things like digital media, cable television, networks like Discovery Channel, History Channel, what have you, to reach some of these consumers that weren't as much sports enthusiasts.
But don't look for Budweiser to completely abandon its cozy relationship with sports. Anheuser-Busch still has sole TV sponsorship for the next three Super Bowls, and Bud advertisements will still blanket the outfield walls and scoreboards of ballparks across the country.
Ice cold Bud Light! Cold Bud Light here!
Watching the Cardinals and Phillies this week in the stadium bearing the Busch family name, if ever there was a place to take in the spectacle of sport and beer, this is it. But Brian Johnson and his friends don't think people buy Bud because they like the ads.
No, I think people buy because they like it. I don't think ads have to do anything to do with it. People buy because of a taste preference, I think.
So if the taste stays the same, you'll keep buying it?
Yeah, sure.
Do you guys like Bud?
I'll drink it.
Even if consumers aren't fans of, say, regular old Bud or Bud Light, many still have a soft spot for the brand. Jeremy Vesta and his friends say they like the ads, but not so much the beer.
The ads are better, but I don't necessarily even drink Budweiser, so it doesn't necessarily affect me. I love their ads. I'll watch them on YouTube, but I'm not going to buy their beer.
Anheuser-Busch topped all sports ad spenders again last year with more than $277 million spent. But the days of Bud's full court press at every major sporting event may be coming to an end. Anheuser-Busch has told NBC it plans to cut its advertising outlays in half for the next two Olympic Games. In St. Louis, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
We read an item this morning about an experiment at the University of the United Arab Emirates. Researchers there want to make it easier for robots to converse with humans. And they're using Facebook to do it. Among other things, the robot is going to use facial recognition software to find your picture on Facebook and then use the information it finds on your page to have a real-life conversation with you. The marketplace players wondered how that might go.
Honey, look, a robot.
Hello, Mr. Jack Johnson.
How'd you know my name?
Facebook, and this must be Jane Smith.
Very good. Hello.
I see your relationship is complicated.
Oh, do I still have that on there?
Is the complication due to the photos on Facebook of John drinking vodka from a woman's belly?
That was college.
I told him to take that down. Why didn't you take that down?
The woman, Sherry Wilson, gets Facebook gifts from John.
Really? I hadn't noticed.
They're silly little things.
Like a little picture of flowers.
Okay, shut up, robot.
On Valentine's Day.
I said be quiet.
No, John. I think we should let him talk.
And he started a Sherry Wilson fan page.
I am so sick of this relationship.
Jane, wait. I hate you, robot. I hate you!
Come back. I just want to chat. I can't wait to blog about this.
Rico Galliano wrote it. Michelle Filippi helped him get it on the air.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, Kraft Foods offers these two indicators of the state of our economy. The company reported first quarter profits today, up 10% overall. But that's not the story. Break it down a little further and you discover this, that cookies are sweet solace in a recession. Oreo profits grew by double digits. Also, cheaper is better. Mac and cheese sales were up too. When we had CEO Irene Rosenfeld on the program for a conversation from the corner office a couple of months ago, you might remember she was pushing grilled cheese pretty hard. And in fact, Kraft singles are apparently selling well, too. That is Marketplace from American Public Media this Wednesday afternoon. Today, the Dow hiked up 101 points, 0.2%. The Nasdaq added 5 points, 0.25%. The S&P 500 rose 15 points, 1.75% there. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gwertz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, the town that gaming built.
The sad part is we have people who don't want to work in a casino. They don't like that work. We need other industries in Tunica.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.